The jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
This is the Hagman and Hagman Report for today. It is Tuesday, December 22nd, 2015. We're coming to you live from the radio and television studios of the Hagman and Hagman Report here in beautiful Northwest Pennsylvania. We're heard live every Monday through Friday, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on the Global Star Radio Network. We're also simulcast on Blog Talk Radio, as well as our own official YouTube channel. If you go to HagmanandHagman.com, which is our internet presence, just click on the whatever venue you wish to listen. Global Star, by far, is the clearest. And, of course, if you'd like to watch, certainly tune in to the official YouTube channel there, our official YouTube channel. But anyway, everything can be found at HagmanandHagman.com. Now, I'm Doug Hagman, the helm of film investigative researcher, and most importantly, my son, Joe Hagman. Together, we are the Hagman and Hagman Report, cutting through the fog of misinformation and digging deep into what the captured mass media won't and will never do. I want to thank, at this point, all of our listeners who have, really just, you know, listeners and viewers, we just value you so much, and we really appreciate everything you do, your prayers, your thoughts, your, everything. Thank you. Thank you. Your support. Man, that's just great. You know, I just want to mention that we read all of our emails. We do read all of our postal mail. I read every scrap. Even if you write a little note on a back of a receipt, I read it. And it's so much. I've learned so much from all of you. Really have. So I want to say thank you so much. Tomorrow night, tonight we're going to have Stan Dale on third hour, of course. Tuesdays of Stan. Wednesday, tomorrow night, will be Steve Quayle. I going to be interviewing him directly about his book Empire Beneath the Ice, but you know, I've read so much by authors such as Peter Lavenda and other authors about the Nazi influence and Hitler surviving and Operation Paperclip and the various operations, OSS and CIA operations and military operations after all of this. But his book, Empire Beneath the Ice, really lays out the missing link as far as I'm concerned, because the intellectual discourse contained in the writings of researchers and authors, there's a reliance there. There's a reliance upon, I'd say, normal government documents that are accessible by anyone. Well, which is fine. I mean, that's the way it should be. Now, Steve, however, combines the information, that information, along with other information that includes information about the Black projects, and brings it to the forefront to today. And this is one thing that I'm going to, and I talked to Steve earlier today about this, because, and I said, look, I've got like a whole list of questions for you. And so it's going to be a dialogue. It's going to be a conversation, because there's so much to this. And if you really want to know, you know, the New World Order is communist in nature. Well, true. All right. And I say sort of kind of true, because there are different facets that are fighting amongst that structure that include the fascists. The Nazis, not neo-Nazis, but the Nazis. And we had John McTernan on about a week ago, who wrote about Israel, as the U.S. does to Israel. And
America does to Israel.
Right, right. And you see, he had mentioned you know, the Nazi camp here in the United States, and not too many people really knew about it. And of course, on Long Island, you had Adolf Hitler Street and Goebbels Street. Really interesting. But that entire... mindset, the not mindset, but ideology, has survived. And see, not just survived, but it's being employed. So on one side of the equation, you've got the communist adherents pushing the New World Order toward this communist agenda. And then on the other side, you've got the fascists, the Nazis, pushing it toward this Nazi ideology. Now, both are goals as well as tactics. Okay? Important to understand. But then you've got the colonialists pushing toward a New World Order. What happens is you've got the waters muddied by multiple agendas, multiple tactics. So when someone talks about the New World Order agenda, we have to clearly define in order not to get all goofed up in terms of understanding. We have to clearly define what agenda, what ideology we're talking about.
It's like the when you look at Satanism. Satanism is different from Luciferianism.
Yes.
Different from paganism.
Yes.
I mean, as odd as it sounds and as interconnected as it may, may seem, they are completely different things. Satanism and Luciferianism, by definition.
Well, right.
And this is what you're
speaking. Yeah. And then you've got, you've got all sorts of subgroups involved as well. And it's really crazy. I'm going to pull up something here. I just happened to think of this and I wanted to, just to give you an idea, for example, you know, because we hear, much about Syria. We hear much about Ukraine. We hear a lot about the things that are taking place here. Let me see if I can find this real quick here. Well, you've got this, and we had mentioned, and in fact, I think during the show that we did about this, this Nazism, we had mentioned that, I'm not sure where I was going with that, but anyway, yeah, it's about talking about getting old, right?
You were talking about Steve and Tamara.
No, but I guess about that whole thing, it's interesting because there are too many people with it. There are so many people with different agendas over there. Somebody sent me an email with an email of a YouTube a guy that went over from, he was a Marine and former Marine. And went over to fight with the Russians, basically, in Syria. Okay, and what many people may not have caught was him saying, "I'm a communist." He was talking about fighting the Nazis. Now, you may take this as saying, "Okay, well, wait. Okay, you're just talking about you're using Nazi as a kind of a." As a just merely a pejorative or a hyperbole, but you're not, okay. You're talking about an ideology, but this guy, he said, "I'm a communist. I'm pushing for communism," and so you've got, I guess what the reason that this is so, to me, this is so. And I'd mentioned during the show that we were seeing the same ground. The same lineup, the same countries, essentially, as it's over here, as right before World War One, and I think that that's probably best said that we're seeing, at least with respect to Russia, as we're looking at the Bolsheviks, you know, the pre-revolution Russia. We're seeing this very familiar pre-World War One. Here we go. Pre-World War One situation, or at least the run up. And I'm going to tell you how in just a second, because when you hear this, you'll think, oh, okay, now this makes a little bit more sense when you throw more players in here. Okay, when you look at the Middle Eastern affairs, you've got three alliances that have been formed and are solidifying right now. You've got France, Germany, and Great Britain. That's put them in one part of the playing field. Germany, France, and Great Britain.
All right.
Now they're fighting against Assad. They want to take Assad out.
What about the U.S.?
Wait a second. These are the main players. Okay. Then you've got Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. They want to take Assad out too, but for different reasons than the first. Then you've got Russia, Iran, Iraq, and of course Syria itself fighting against the other two factions. Well, what about the U.S.? Now, NATO sent a message of support to Turkey, and NATO, of course, is the U.S. So we appear to be...
Well, it's a coalition of nations, but...
Right, we appear to be cozying up with Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar.
Not to interrupt you.
Yes, but you
I don't know if you're going this way or not, but there is a article on Zero Hedge and it's on a number of other sites about Seymour Hersh bombshell, U.S. military shared intelligence, and I'm having really slow internet here, shared intelligence with Assad in defiance of Obama as the CIA supported the Syrian rebels. Back in May, Seymour Hersh upended the official narrative surrounding the death of Osama bin Laden and in the process created a media firestorm prompting a response from the White House. The explosive revelations about the events that ultimately led to the bin Laden demise came a year and a half after Hersh accused the Obama administration of not telling the whole story in regards to the infamous sarin gas attack that nearly served as an excuse for airstrikes against the Assad regime in 2013. Now, it goes on to lay out...
Now, when you talk about... What did you say about airstrikes, but did you mention chemical weapons?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Hersh accuses the Obama administration of not telling the whole story in regard to the sarin gas attacks that nearly served as an excuse for airstrikes
Okay, that's
the
I wanted to make sure I understood that correctly because
but here it describes you have the intelligence and you know Pentagon working with one side sharing intelligence with Assad. Then you have the CIA and other administrative groups working with the rebels trying to oust Assad.
Right.
So you have a government who is divided. You have the you know the Defense Department, the Pentagon working and sharing intelligence with Assad, and you have the intelligence agencies.
Correct.
And the administration on the other side.
Well...
And that's a very short summarization.
You've got essentially what you've got is the CIA, the real player here. Okay, behind the scenes, you've got the CIA. Now you have the Department of Defense or the American military, who are placing assets on the ground in Syria. As in an advisor capacity, much like we did in Vietnam, pre-Kennedy, or leading up to Kennedy. It's interesting because the situation mirrors. Yes, it mirrors pre-World War One, and I specifically say pre-World War One because we are still fighting World War One. And but having said that, there are also certain components of this that make it look like, well, wait a minute, you know, we're also looking at some similarities between today and Vietnam. But yeah, you're correct.
Here it is. Joint Chiefs of Staff official: U.S. military gave intel to Assad while CIA funded and armed ISIS.
Right.
The Pentagon's Joint Chiefs of Staff have been indirectly providing intelligence on the Islamic State to the government of Syrian President Bashar Assad, in direct contrast to the Obama administration's agenda of regime change in an effort to stop Syria from becoming another failed state from which terrorists can operate. A recent investigation by renowned journalist Seymour Hersh provides clear evidence of a massive disconnect between the Obama's White House and U.S. military regarding the handling of the Syrian situation. The awkward situation stems from Obama administration's insistence that there are moderate rebel groups to arm that are capable of defeating Assad, and the subsequent decision to provide weapons to these jihadist groups through a covert CIA program.
Right.
And while this is going on by the president and the CIA, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Pentagon are feeding intelligence to Assad and the Syrian government through a number of intermediary governments and unidentified advisors.
Right. Now, bear in mind, none of this would have happened. You know, and I say this, and I say this, and I say this. None of this would have happened had we had the appropriate vetting process in at the beginning of the elections in 2007. Had the establishment Republicans and their sycophants said, "Hey, you know, let's find out who Obama is, because Obama, it's just not Obama as a renegade, but every person associated with this idiot bringing people in."
I agree with you to an extent, but let me ask you this: if Hillary served the term that Obama just did, would it be any different?
Yeah, probably. I'm going to say, would it be different? You know, yeah, I think some roadblocks would have been thrown up. I mean, Obama came in already having that Islamic bent. Okay, I don't think throwing Hillary in here. I would
be. She would have got away with as much.
I don't think that she would have been able to pull off the Arab Spring. Okay, because we know the Arab Spring was really a byproduct. Yeah, but you needed a guy in the Oval Office that was selected to be able to kind of be part of.
Yeah.
Well, we say
started it, he started the destabilization of nations in the Middle East.
Right.
And when PNAC came out, the Project for a New American Century, they listed seven countries that needed to be destabilized in order to bring in democracy in exchange for the U.S. hold on resources.
Right. Yes, that's true.
And the protection of the petrodollar.
Right. But folks, but the important thing is here, when we look at the events taking place overseas, over in Syria and over in the Middle East, again, please understand, what do we have during the First World War? We had this triple alliance form pre-World War I. You had that involved the Ottoman Caliphate, and let's remember when I spoke last week, we were talking, or whenever that show was, we were talking about how the Nazis were using the Muslims, and how that whole jihadist concept really was exploited during World War One, and then refined during World War Two. It was brought in during World War One, and then refined during World War Two. But what we're seeing here is this triple alliance, pre-World War One alliance, as well as now France, Germany, and Great Britain to go against Assad, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar going against Assad, Russia, Iran, Iraq, and Syria being with Assad, America supporting Turkey via NATO, and in fact, NATO even sent a message of support to Turkey. And that would put the United States right in the same camp with Saudi Arabia. So what we're saying is Saudi Arabia seems to be calling the shots as it stands with the Islamic takeover, using the United States military assets to employ or to engage other countries. It's complicated. Believe me, this is not an us versus them or good guys versus bad guys. It's good guys, bad guys, bad guys, bad guys, good guys, bad guys, bad guys.
No guys.
I mean, it's pretty much everybody is, you know, it's there's multifacets to this whole thing. So
who's the good
I understand.
Guys?
Who are the good guys?
Who are the good guys?
The good guys are saying, hey, the good guys are. Or us,
the good guys are the ones that probably fled.
Well, we're trying to expose this, and I think.
Well, I mean,
who are the good guys in this? it's a matter of degree, isn't it? A matter of relative, it's a relative question, because it's like...
It's not the U.S.
Gaddafi, for example. Okay, Gaddafi, Libya had a very high standard of living.
The highest in Africa.
Right. And Hillary Clinton went in there at the bidding of Obama, Barry Satoro, who was really doing the bidding of the Sauds to take out the Saudi Arabians, to take out Gaddafi. Okay? So now, but those people are just players of the globalists who are actually doing the calling the shots and the funding. So, you know, now was Gaddafi a good guy? Well, if you ask his victims of torture and you know,
the Lockerbie bombing.
Okay, if you ask,
I mean,
no, he's
not
admit a good
to
guy.
That? Yeah,
but is he a good guy relative to ISIS? Well, yeah, okay, but they're all so. You know, it's not, and this is the thing that bothers me is when you see on forums this discussion, these discussions saying, well, you know, Assad's good or Assad's bad. Okay, what are you proposing to put into place? And also, is it our job as a kind of, what does the Constitution say about foreign entanglements? Or George Washington? Or others say about foreign entanglements with our country?
I would say what the Constitution says is irrelevant, not because it is our founding document,
it's because it's been shredded.
Yeah.
And it's been shredded by both the right and the left. And this is the other thing, too, I want to caution people on. You know, Donald Trump is saying a whole lot of things that a lot of people are thinking and want to say.
Yep.
I'm going to tell you,
it's
flat
like
out.
Putin. People are jumping on this bandwagon.
Yep.
Because they like what they hear.
Right. Now, my question is, if Donald Trump says, well, we need to do this, this, and this, and it's not constitutional, it doesn't conform to the Constitution, yet it's the right thing to do, does that make it right? I don't think so. No, I don't think so. So we have to be very grounded, intellectually grounded. So how do we become intellectually grounded? We tap into our spiritual prayer, like, you know, we have to employ prayer. We have to balance everything against the scriptures as well as the Constitution. But if it's not constitutional for Obama, then it's not constitutional for Trump. If on one side, and we're gonna play an audio, folks. Wait until the second hour. We're gonna play an audio, or a video and audio from Representative Ben Sasse. All right, he's a freshman congressman. I don't know whether you heard this or not.
No, I haven't.
Senator Ben Sasse. His maiden speech on the Senate floor. It's going to be about 16 minutes. We're going to be playing that here soon. Well, what he brings up is the fact that this really is kind of what this is all about. What we're seeing today, domestically and in the foreign sector, we're seeing this consolidation of power. You're seeing the executive branch consolidate power by taking power away from the legislative branch. It's not supposed to be that way. One does not, as an executive, as a person behind in the Oval Office, they do not rule by executive fiat. Laws are made by Congress, not by the president, not by executive order. All right, so that's. So he addresses this, and he also addresses, too, this Republican, Democrat, right, left, conservative, progressive rift, and asks some very interesting questions. He understands the Constitution. The question, however, is whether it's going to make a difference. Now, we can talk all night and all day and all night and all day about what it should be. But, you know, what is it going to be? Okay, that's the thing. And you know, this nation is under judgment. And I don't know whether you saw this or is beginning to be under judgment. Received word from Pastor Langford about Franklin Graham. You know, he's initiating a prayer, just a he's encouraging everyone to pray and even be part of the, you know, encouraging pastors and what have you to run for office where possible as a last, and repent, but as a last ditch effort to save this country. But it's interesting because Franklin Graham kind of departed from, or the Republican Party, or the conservative Republican Party, or they departed from him. It doesn't really matter which, but people are beginning to recognize, I guess the important thing is people are beginning to recognize the fact that it's not, it is not right now. This whole thing's not going to be solved politically. People understand this, and there's ire out there. There's anger. There's frustration that the political, reins have been broken. The rules have been stomped upon by the very people that have been elected. I mean, how many Lindsey Grahams can you put up with? How many John McCains can you put up with? How many Paul Ryans can you put up with? I watched the absolute meltdown with Paul Ryan on here's the way I look at it. When you go on the internet, you get a whole bunch of people that really are just yipping and yamming. A lot of people have no life, okay? So no real life outside of the screen. But when you look at there's like two major political forums that accept people's comments and stories, you know, one the Democratic Underground and the other Free Republic. And to watch the mindless, useless, senseless arguments between the two over these political issues, it just kind of made me chuckle because really, how many of these chuckleheads out there really believe that there's going to be change? A lot of them do. Oh yeah, it's Paul Ryan. Oh my goodness, yeah. I can't wait. All right. Yeah. How's that working out for you? And then on the other side, you've got the Bernie Sanders, the people who worship Bernie Sanders, reporting him saying, oh, well, this is going to be horrible. Paul Ryan, this is going to be horrible. Oh, when it comes right down to it, you got one party. And it's the party of royalty. It's not the party of anything else but royalty. And this, again, this is what the, freshman senator is going to reference. It's an excellent speech. But it speaks about it speaks to the spiritual as well as talking about the political. So it's really interesting. So I just wanted to kind of lay that groundwork. And, you know, we are really at the precipice of war. And regardless, you know, you want to, regardless, we're at the precipice of a world war. And not only are we at the precipice of a world war, we're at the precipice of a civil war.
And an intergalactic war.
Well, yeah, no, right. Okay. But the Civil War, especially, because now the Civil War is broken down, we can break this down into the economic disparities. Because it's us versus them, or them versus us. You've got the 1% versus everyone else, the 99%. The 1% have the money. The 99% are the workers like us that we can all get to shovel our own driveways, and we have to shovel, you know, dig ditches and what have you. I mean, that's us. And then you got the 1% who bully, push around, and believe that transhumanism is going to elevate them to, you know, to God's apotheosis. You know, here to apotheosis. And they're going to become godlike. So that's them. So you've got the social disparity, the economic disparity. And when I say social and economic go hand in hand, because the social disparity are the ones who believe that they want to worship Mother Earth, and they want to be gods themselves. And that's why I mentioned apotheosis, is because that's, you know, achieving godhood that's their goal as well, which happened to be the goal of the Nazis through their various occult beliefs and ideologies. Then you've got the racial divide. You've got the black versus the white, and you've got the now more infamous, it's always been
and always will be, a few media stories at the, tip
of
the...
But see, the majority of people out there, and I really mean this, the majority of people out there, the blacks and the whites, get along fine. I'm going to tell you, really, you got a black friend, I got a black friend, you got a white friend, you're black, and you get along fine. It's when you have the Tavistockian, That's my new word. I don't even think that's a word, but the Tavistock Institute of Mind Control, pushing. When I say mind control, I believe it's social engineering, so might as well be mind control. Yeah, that Tavistock kind of influence, really, through the leadership pushing, exploiting the racial divide. We're seeing this take place, but we're throwing a new element here into the mix. All right. In addition to the, remember, a decade ago plus, it was the blacks and the whites and Mexicans. There was like a three-way, kind of a three-way war, if you will. Now add in the Muslims. But see, Muslims, or Islam, is not a race. And this is where the media conflates the whole problem. Islam is not a race. It is a, Loretta Lynch and the people at the Department of Justice, turn on your transcribing machines. You ready? Islam is not a race. It is a cult. It's not a religion. It is a cult. Just make sure this is purely the opinion, researched, reasoned opinion of the host of the Hagman and Hagman Report, Douglas J. Hagman. No one else's, not Global Star, not BTR, not YouTube, not Eric the Tech, not my wife, not my dog, not my, just me. Okay.
Eric, what's the DOJ anti-Muslim tip line?
Just put everybody's got to be a comedian, you know. Really, no, I love it. But see, so you've got the cult of Islam, and by definition, and I could say it's a cult. It's because it mixes this political ideology and culture, because like a hijab, whatever, those burlap sacks over the head, whatever you call those things with the slits in the eyes. There's nothing Muslim about that. Do you know that? No, that's cultural. That's not religious. That's cultural. And therein lies the difference. You see, people mix things up. Wait a minute. That's a Muslim thing. No, that's a cultural thing that's tied to Islam, but it's culture. It's not religious. It's not a religious requirement.
If I'm remembering right, it's actually in the Bible. Not the big, but the garbs, the wear, the covering of the face, that goes to Old Testament times, but not the headdress you're speaking.
You mean the burlap sack?
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
The funny looking hat.
Yeah, I do.
But the style of the dress, the concealment of the face and the skin is a Middle Eastern thing, and it's a biblical thing from the Old Testament.
It is.
Okay, but not in the context that
it's
is
not
being
a law or
No. It's a culture. It's a tradition.
Right.
It's not.
Right.
It's not. So we have to understand this. And to those who say, "Well, we're all just the one human entity. We're all just part of the human race." Yeah, that's true. Pretty damn simplistic, but true. Because I believe that as well. But when you start looking at this a little bit and start understanding, and see, this is why I say too many times, it's not what we necessarily believe as Christians or as residents of New York or Pennsylvania or residents of California or whatever your mindset may, it's not what we believe, it's what they believe that we have to pay attention to. All right. Not because it's important to us directly, but it will become important to us indirectly when the attacks happen and when things just kind of bam, go bang and stuff. You got to understand why. So that's what, for example, when we have Matt Peterson on, who's a researcher, and he talks about the numerical aspects of this. Yeah, there is biblical numerology, and then there's the counterfeiting and the exploitation of biblical numerology, okay, that we have to look at. So while we believe, for example, a certain number or a certain period of time has importance to our faith, they believe it has a different importance to their faith, which is counterfeit to ours. Do you understand what I'm saying about all of this? That's kind of like a big wrap-up. But, bottom line, we have this real nasty situation shaping up over in Syria. And a lot of people will say, well, Ukraine's part of this too. Ukraine, any moment, Ukraine's going to blow. Okay, yeah, you have to go back to World War II to understand the machinations between the Ukrainians, those people from Kiev, and the Ukrainians and Russia. And you have to really kind of understand the underpinnings of that geopolitical situation to understand where we are today and how we got here today. But is it too hard now to look at people like Zbigniew Brzezinski and Kissinger and those people who Obama have tapped on the shoulder in 2007 to push his foreign policy, as well as Clinton, and even some of the people today, Carson included, talking to Kissinger, allegedly talking to Kissinger about, you know, developing foreign policy. And then you've got Cruz, who Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution most likely would not allow him to be president, yet no one gives a doggone about that, right? So his wife is a CFR member. I mean, really.
Did you see the Council on Foreign Relations endorsed Ted Cruz?
Gee, what a surprise. Okay, that's like my wife being on the committee to elect Doug Hagman, or, you know, that's like my wife being, you know,
actually, that
is a surprise.
No.
Wow, surprise. I mean, you get the analogy. I mean, look, our audience is very intelligent. They know. But really? I mean, does that surprise anyone? Although he may not be eligible according to the Constitution, according to Section 1, Article 2 of the Constitution. Thanks, lady. I'm glad you agree with me, honey. Our studio dog brought her in.
And there's been talk about, you know, Trump being the leader, Cruz being the running mate. Wouldn't it be interesting to see Trump accept Cruz as a running mate without bringing up that issue after being so outspoken?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, the other part is too. We look at, and I started this out by saying we look at Donald Trump, and we look at the fact that he's saying a lot of things what people want to hear, and we. Yeah, I just want to caution everyone. You're either with the Constitution, you're either respectful of the Constitution, or you're not. I'm talking politically. And let me say something, because I'm so sick and tired of getting emails about something. And I'm going to tell you something right now. Okay. I take the Bible as being the literal word of God. Okay. I measure my, if somebody makes a statement on this program, you measure it against the Word of God, against the Bible, all right? If I want to seek a man's explanation for let's say I want to discuss something with about the Bible, I'm allowed to talk to a pastor, right? But in the end, it's the Bible. I get tired of people saying, well, the Bible is the be-all, end-all. Yes, I know that. You don't have to hammer that home to me. You don't have to send me email after email after email after email after email after email. Am I getting my point across after email? Am I getting my point across? Am I getting my point across? You don't have to do it. I got it.
I'm sending one right now.
I understand. The Bible is the Word of God. I believe it. You're upsetting my dog.
Who's upsetting the dog?
I got it. I understand. It's the final arbiter. When we talk politics, the Constitution is the be-all and end-all. One is not mutually exclusive of the other. If you can walk and chew gum at the same time, you can hold the Constitution in one hand and the Bible in the other hand and be just fine. And not have any contradictory, not necessarily anything contradictory. You can build a wall and fight off the enemy with a sword in the other, with one hand, and fight off the enemy with a sword in the other. I think that might be a story in the Bible about that. Okay. Got my dog upset. My wife's over there wondering what's going on. She came into the studio earlier. Apparently use a copier. I don't know how you doing. One more thing. Remember the Paris attacks? Remember those? Joe's got an interesting story about that, but 382 of 382 of 383 Syrian refugees admitted since the Paris attacks admitted in this country. You have 382 refugees admitted into the United States since the Paris attacks, all Muslim. How many Christians? One. One. So, let me get this straight. You got 383 total people, men between the ages of 95% are men between the ages of 14 and 50. It's a pretty good fighting age, you think? I'm reading this wrong here, but the majority are fighting age men, and they're all Muslims. 382 are Muslims, one Christian. What's wrong with this picture? You got the Homeland Security Committee Chairman, Representative Michael McCaul, saying the Intelligence Committee had already identified individuals tied to terrorist organizations in Syria that want to exploit and get into the United States through refugee processes. You think? They're already here. 99.1% of the refugees admitted into this country this calendar year have been Muslim. 99.1. What do you think? Why? Why? Is that... soon now, according to the lynch mob, and soon according to the Department of Justice, and soon according to the Department of Homeland Security, and soon now because of CISPA, and all the other crap that's passed.
Yep.
Okay. Soon, we're going to have to give equal time to the, you know, to the Council on American Islamic Relations shills and the Islamic Society idiots and the people who want to take over this country by their, you know, they're going to conquer us through demographics, they're going to conquer us through politics, they're going to conquer us through religion, and they're going to use the First Amendment to hit us over the head with, and they're going to take the Second Amendment, take that away from us so we can't protect the First Amendment, and you get a whole bunch of Marxist, liberal, progressive idiots going, hey, 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 like little monkeys, you know, like little monkeys. Did you ever see those monkeys with the, you know what I'm talking about? The things that dance on the desk, and they got the little symbols, monkeys. You know what I'm talking about. You can find them on just about any political forum that you go to. Go ahead, I'm done. I'm done. Go.
Only 48 minutes into the first hour. Sure, you don't want to finish up?
No, I can go.
I can go.
Believe me, I'm ready.
Cybersecurity legislation passes
Congress. You know what? You want me to go? I'm just kidding.
And I have the bill right here. They published 136 pages out of 2,009 pages. And what they've published, from what I've read so far, I've gotten about 20 pages through. It is just definitions and laws that they cite. But CISPA, the final text of the cybersecurity legislation passed Congress as part of a $1.1 trillion spending package. This happened last Friday. The legislation was approved by a 316-113 majority in the House, with 95 Republicans and 18 Democrats voting in opposition. It passed the Senate 65-33. The completed text of the cybersecurity component was less intrusive than some privacy advocates feared, though still short of what they desired. Calling it the New Patriot Act, privacy group Fight for the Future said the legislation would dramatically expand surveillance programs and make the nation more vulnerable by letting corporations off the hook instead of holding them accountable when they fail to protect sensitive information of customers. The Cybersecurity Act of 2015 as it was titled, begins on page 1728 of the 2009-page omnibus package, which is edited, frankly, in the days leading up to its passage. Nonetheless, elements of the earlier privacy provisions managed to survive, including a requirement that the Department of Homeland Security takes most of the responsibility for the processing of information shared by private companies. The most significant feature of the legislation is that it will provide civil liability relief for companies that share customer information with other companies and the government for reasons they deem relevant to a cybersecurity threat. For instance, it could provide liability protection for a telecommunication company that shares information about its cellular subscribers. In theory, companies are required to strip out personally identifiable information or data.
See,
that they know to be related.
This has been going on. It's just been codified. Go ahead.
Yeah. And the critics say that this requirement is so vague, it could allow the government to harvest even more information than it has in under past surveillance regimes.
Right.
It's a weak requirement, said Evan Greer, executive director of the Fight for the Future. Companies only have to remove info that they know is unrelated to identifying the cyber threat, which is vague enough to make the restriction meaningless, he added. Homeland Security Chairman Chairman Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, acknowledged after the bill's passage, "It's a big step in the right direction. The legislation protects us. It's necessary and it's long overdue."
Well,
but no, this
essentially
is
CISPA has been passed. Bottom line, has been passed under a different name. We are now at the mercy of the.
Basically, we are
technologically naked. We've been stripped of all of our technological privacy. They can get anything, anytime. Not that they haven't been doing that already, but now it's codified. It's a matter of law. So if you type anything you type on the computer, let me tell you something. You might as well consider it as being put on the side of your house in luminous spray paint, because that's exactly what it is. Plus, we are now going to be subjected to not just the lack of privacy and the collection of data, and the fact that they can rip into any file that they want to do. But the fact of the matter is this: we are going to be compelled by law. And this is ridiculous, but we're going to be compelled by law to pushing papers. I mean,
this is a new article from today dealing with health information.
Right.
Technology.
Okay. The other we can go into the health too, but we have no privacy. And the important thing to remember with this newly named CISPA, it's not just about the information. It's about who controls the information.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just information.
That's it.
It's behavior.
Correct. Everything. You know, when you look at this, and I didn't believe this, when you look at the monitor or look at the camera, you know, or Facebook, and you can see it on Facebook, you know, who's this pops up, I guess, or whatever, you know, when it just blocks a face and it's facial recognition. But see, now the entirety of all the smart appliances are gathered together. It's all being funneled. This big funnel, this big net has been cast over all of this digital information. It is now being controlled, and it's all about control. It's all about central.
Yep.
As much as it is about information collection.
Yes, it is. And when the closing minutes here, adding to what you said, this is from this website is healthitsecurity.com. And ensuring adequate privacy and security protections is extremely important to providers and patients as record keeping moves from paper based records to standalone electronic interconnected health records. Now, listen close. There are complex privacy and security challenges when it comes to health information exchange. In its December report to Congress, the Health IT claimed that the HIE privacy and security issues, which is the Health IT security, were just some of the interoperability challenges currently facing the industry, a lack of universal adaptation of standard electronic health systems, or weak incentives are also included as a list of barriers. Ensuring adequate privacy and security protections is extremely important to providers and patients as record-keeping moves from a paper-based to standalone interconnected electronic health records.
You might as well just say it this way, Joe. All right. Our health records are out there on the internet. They're all of them are.
And okay. They're going to say this is going to force
right.
formalization of privacy and security policies and practices.
Correct. But see, one breach, two breach, five breaches, or any number of breaches will give the excuse and the legitimate excuse, or ostensibly legitimate, to say, well, we can't have this, so we have to take the information off of the internet, give that information to the patient. So
yep. They call it person-centered healthcare.
Right. So doesn't this sound good, everybody? I want everyone to line up right
patient-centered
now.
Patient-centered healthcare.
Look, you got to get in line right now, like the Star Wars people were. Because if you're not, you're lost. I mean, my goodness, the Star Wars thing, you know, so this is even better. Better than Star Wars. So line up. You line up, and all the stuff Joe's talking about here, we can't have this on the internet, so here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna make sure, we're gonna tattoo you. Or chip you. Or do something to you.
Yeah,
to make sure, we're gonna give you a card first. That's what we'll do. We'll give you a card. But see, then you'll lose that card. With all the health information on it, and you keep it in your wallet. So when you go to the doctor, you pull out your wallet and you hand it to the doctor, the card to the doctor's office, and they scan it, swipe it, you know, and they say, okay, you're right. But see, you can lose that. No.
Right. And plus, there's other data, the genomic data.
Right.
That is person specific.
So everybody can start lining up right now, okay, because, you know, maybe we can get it done before Christmas. Line up right now, and we'll tattoo you with certain electronic ink or yep. even a chip or something.
And in their new strategic implementation plan, they state that the collecting of information from individual persons' health records, as well as other relevant information, is going to help population health management as well as public health. And they are going to, through medical devices. Standards are the medium for individuals, health IT solutions, and medical devices. Organize, exchange, secure, and share information are emerging requirements, including use of genomic data, precision medicine.
Right.
They're using health IT and data elements to collect information for health individual needs. They are implementing digitized protected health information to ensure that all people, this is all Americans, all inclusive, adhere to the laws under the HHS Secretary's Strategic Initiative, and going back to the Affordable Care Act, the federal government is committed to developing and using policy and technology to advance patients to make choices for their electronic health information. It also will develop policy, standards, technology to facilitate patients' ability to control the disclosure of specific information in an electronic environment. This includes reproductive health, substance abuse treatment, mental health, behavioral modification, all and is encompassing in the protected health information.
Well, as we're minutes away from the top of the hour break, as crazy as that sounds, let me toss another crazy thing out to you. Next time you go to the hospital to have a surgery and you get blood, just remember, okay, the FDA lifted a ban on homosexuals and sodomites. The Food and Drug Administration lifted the ban on blood donations from sodomites, from guys who have engaged in sex with other men. Now, in order to donate blood, a man will have to have been abstinent for the period of 1 year prior to donation. But we all know that they're extremely, extremely truthful. You know, they're going to pinky swear.
Well, they say that, okay. You know, through the use of this health technology, will allow the whole nation to achieve important health outcomes, including the prevention of chronic and debilitating diseases.
Well, this is all BS. Look, we are being put into this position where we are now into the, they're now going to allow into the blood banks the blood of potentially HIV positive blood. In my view, in my opinion, whatever disclaimer I need to have in there, well, it's not really, it's true. The FDA says, okay, I'm going to lift the ban on blood donations from guys who have had, abnormal sex with other guys, okay?
I guess the question is, will that be tested before it is redistributed?
Hell no, because we don't want to do that. What we want to do is introduce this into the patient stream. So, here's my view. If you have the ability to bank your own blood, do so. If not, no, you're going to get Steve and Bob's and Bruce's potentially contaminated blood. You're listening to the Hagman Hagman Report on this 22nd day of December 2015. Hagman's in a bad mood. We'll be right back.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.